Good evening and welcome to the June episode of the Three Horsemen Plus One. Sorry for the delay, but as usual with us old folk, real life intervenes, and we seem to always find excuses not to record. Not that we don't love you guys, but it happens. So with us tonight, as usual, is Mr. Jeff Patterson.
Hi, everyone. Jeff Patterson. You can find me, Jeff Patterson 11, at Twitter. I blog at Gravity Lens, which can be found at baddaystudio.com.
And also with us tonight is Mr. John Stevens.
I am here, surprisingly. Not really. And I am I'm a blogger for SF Signal and a writer and a general all-around pain in the ass.
And also tonight, we are not only continuing our tradition that we started last episode, but extending it. So please join me in welcoming Kate Sherrod of Kate of Mind and many other online sources. Kate?
It's actually Kate Sherrod. It runs. Which George Trab still thinks is hilarious that I tell people how to pronounce it that way. But yes, it rhymes with Hate Your God. And I'm Kate Sherrod. I'm Kate Sherrod on Twitter, and I blog at Kate of Mind. And I'm also that weird chick who invented suppertime sonnets. I challenged myself to write and post a really geeky Shakespearean sonnet every day for over 2 years, and I published a book. And that's at suppertimesonnets.blogspot.com. Sonnets about the space shuttle and insect species and how I didn't think the last Cylon was going to be Ellen Ty.
Spoilers.
I didn't say they were accurate sonnets, but they were geeky. You got to say that.
Yep. Well, where to begin? I believe, Jeff, actually, you would like to.
We're recording this on the day that we found out that Jay Lake died after his prolonged battle with cancer. Two things are coming to mind. Number one, WorldCon in Montreal, where I did the Walking with the Stars, where a bunch of authors and editors walked around Old Town Montreal every morning before anyone else was up and hungover. And the two that I went to, Jay Lake was on both of them, and I got to talk with him briefly during one of them. And the other thing that comes to mind, which Mr. DiNardo mentioned when he put the posting up today, was when Paul Cornell held up the sign that said, "We love you, Jay," at the last Yugos in San Antonio, and everybody screamed it very, very loudly. We all followed it. Fred, you were a cheerleader when it came to the fundraiser for the genome. You were one of the loudest cheerleaders that I recall. And it's one of those things, you know, I don't want to say we knew it was coming, but we all had hopes, but still it didn't take the sting out of it when it happened.
Nope. My experiences with Jay were mostly online. For example, I answered some trivia about his City of Flowers books, and as a result got a pair of signed books from him.
Oh.
And, yes, the fundraiser, which hope, you know, maybe in a few years something good will come out of it, and it'll have his name on it.
I think I've got a signed, I think he signed my Death of a Starship. I forget which con it was at, though. The other thing I wanted to mention about it was a few hours after that happened, our dear friend and comrade at SF Signal,
Sarah Chorn,
I'm reading three different notes here. Sarah Chorn put up a posting regarding Jay and her own battles with cancer in her life, and she mentioned that she has gone back on active cancer meds. I recommend everybody go read her post at her website. And I think she really made some really good points about what Jay was like and the inspiration he gave after his last diagnosis and as it through all the various trials that he went through. And I feel for Sarah a lot because she really opened my eyes to a lot of stuff with the columns she's been doing for SF Signal, and the podcasts I've done with her have just been so enjoyable because she is on. So I want everybody to go and read her stuff regarding it.
I second that emotion.
Good.
Yeah. It's hard. I've been thinking a lot about actually both Jay and Sarah. It's weird the way that both of their struggles sort of impact me because both of my parents died of cancer. And I was since I'm the only child, I was their caretaker. And it's very sobering to listen to people actually try to make sense of this thing. Like, my parents just didn't have the apparatus to make sense of what was happening to them. And they tried to deal with it as best they could. But to watch Jay really try to struggle with not just being honest about the process, but actually trying to give to people, say, this is the best, as best I can, here's what it's like. And this is why it is sort of like the most, you know, one of the most horrible things that can happen to you. Mm-hmm. This is why. And that just makes me feel for Sarah really doubly so. Because she's gone through it twice. This is her third round. It gets, you know, harder each time, and it never gets easier. It's just a tougher and tougher battle. And, you know, and as she said in her column, and I think Jay even said at some point too, in one of his writings, cancer is just a thief. It just tries to take every single thing from you. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't care. It's an uncaring thing that just tries to steal everything from you, including your life. And how do you deal with that? And I think Jay really showed a lot of people what it does to you, but also how you can find the resources to at least try to shake your fist at it a bit before it steals too much from you.
Mm-hmm. He also went out of his way to... I'm sorry, say again?
Oh, that's a perfect image. That's really all we can do from as dignified a posture as possible.
Yes.
We talked about the fundraiser that he had for the genome sequencing, and just the sheer amount of data that came out of that alone. You know, he was especially proud of. I remember him writing about that. So. Well,
Sarah, if you can hear us, I hope we're all pulling for you, and very proud of the example you're setting for everybody else.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I cannot wait to do more podcasts with her, quite frankly. So.
Right on.
All right, but we were going to talk about Octavia Butler this evening, I believe.
That's who? Correct. What? Yes. Oh, my God. I love this woman.
That's why you're here.
Well, and when we lost her in 2006, I started rationing her books when I realized there was now a finite supply. Mm. So I haven't read the parable books, which seem to be everybody's favorites. I haven't read them yet. I'm saving them. It's just like I've rationed Philip K. Dick for the same reason, because there's only so many to go around. But she is one of my literary heroes. I'm a white girl from Wyoming, and she made me realize, she opened my eyes to a lot of different experiences in her fiction and just in the example that she set. So she was born right after World War II in San Francisco, and her dad was a shoe shiner. It was this classic, you know, I can't even comment, classic African-American story. And she was a geeky little girl who loved her science fiction. And at one point, she was diagnosed with dyslexia. And despite all of that, she said, well, I'm going to write my stories. And she did. She's amazing. So I think, Jeff, you mentioned you've read probably my favorite of hers, which is the Lilith Brood books.
Mm-hmm. I think I've read everything. The Lilith Brood books are the ones that stand out for me because number one, I tend to be much more of a weird SF fan than most of the traditional tropes. And
about as weird as they get.
Yeah, it is. Well, something I was thinking about when I was actually going through and you know, just flipping through some of my favorite chapters from those books in the last week or so for this was a thought that actually occurred to me after I read the three of them, I actually started reading that trilogy in their original form, in the original, it was the Xenogenesis trilogy, it was called at the time, I believe, before they got re-released. The first book, Dawn, had actually been a selection of the Connecticut Library Association Summer Reading Club, which I've talked about before on this podcast, because Sam Delaney was teaching comparative lit at UMass at the time, and he was actually one of the keynote people that wrapped that whole series of lectures up. And in reading it, something that kind of occurred to me, I thought the guy that ran the class wasn't all that familiar with SF, but he was trying to find a way to compare it and contrast it to other stuff. And so a really weird thought happened to me, because the book that I had read immediately before that had been The Uplift War by David Brin. and I thought that if anything, Xenogenesis as an arc, it was almost like a counter reaction to the Brin story, wherein the Brin story took, you know, humans and aliens and put them in a pretty boilerplate adventure story. What Butler did was told a story about humanity interacting inextricably with an alien race. I mean, suddenly they are eventually literally tied at the hip with this race, because basically they salvaged part of humanity after things go pear-shaped here on Earth. And it was the approach she took to interacting with aliens, and it wasn't simply a matter of, oh, these are aliens that have a different set of customs, or these are aliens that have a slightly different yet relatable way of thinking, like we see in so many science fiction franchises. But this was something that was utterly alien and that was utterly repulsive until we and the characters got to know them. And that was what really fascinated me the most, wherein humans in so many science fiction novels basically make judgment calls about the aliens that they encounter. This was actually a learning arc that both races had to have, and I had never seen that before in a book.
Yeah. Well, what really grabbed me with it, and again also with her Pattern Master series, was, and I wonder how much of this is just informed by her experience of American culture and African American history. She wrote some SF that was more explicitly about slavery, but really what she got into here was the idea that our cherished notions of freedom and autonomy could be kind of a joke, because at bottom we're still biological animals. And for instance, in the Lilith's Brood, the Xenogenesis books, we're basically kind of coerced almost into interbreeding with our alien saviors. And especially right. In the Pattern Master books, the Klazark organism is basically a not quite a parasite, but definitely an invading organism that an expedition brings back to Earth. And it's basically a disease, but it's a disease that produces certain compulsions and also changes our germline so that, you know, the first generations of children born with that organism in their genome are quadrupeds. So just the idea that autonomy is way more rare and possibly not even really a thing. So I've always kind of thought about how a slavery informed narrative could be made something more relatable to everyone, and I can't think of a better example than these books.
So, no, that's an angle I've never thought of before, actually. So
yeah, so I could always just imagine, you know, people talking about free will in her presence, and her just getting this eerie little smile about it.
Yeah, know? I think I actually saw her on a panel at ReaderCon regarding free will and determinism it was something specific. I don't think it was Golden Age, and I don't think it was New Wave, but some movement within science fiction. I'll have to go back and look at my my ReaderCon programs. But yeah, she was on a panel regarding that. She was a mainstay at ReaderCon for a while. So.
She was just before my time. I think I literally started doing ReaderCon like right after. Yeah, I missed her, which is sad.
Mm-hmm. Well, and so she's been a lot on my mind, not just preparing for this, but with Maya Angelou having just passed away. And so hearing I four or five different places, her poem, I Shall Rise, I might have the title wrong there. But for me, those two, Maya Angelou and Octavia E. Butler, have always really kind of been intertwined in my head. So it's kind of like losing Butler all over again.
Mm. Wow. John, what about you?
God, it's funny. I was doing a little selective rereading this afternoon for a little while. Trying to gather a few thoughts on the material itself, and then sort of its significance to me and my history with it, and it just ended up feeling kind of overwhelming, because I find that the issues that she talks about are not just they're deeply philosophical, they're ontological, they're about the meaning of life and functioning in life, and hearing Kate talk about, you know, just the idea of autonomy and the idea of free will versus, you know, biology, nature versus nurture, you know, the engineering of, you know, life, issues of consent. I mean, that really is like, if you look at her entire, Butler's entire output, she really does keep coming back to this question, not just of autonomy, but of power in relationships. Like all of her books just constantly would come back to, in some configuration, the question of power of relationships. I have not read the Pattern Master books. I've read most of Butler's other work, but I haven't read the Pattern Master stuff. But I reread a chunk of Dawn earlier today, and I flipped through Fledgling a little bit because I just finished it, rereading a couple of sections that I was curious about. And just thinking about what I think about, like what comes to my mind when I think about Butler and her significance, is that she really kept hammering away at this idea that, you know, it's not just a question of, you know, do we have free will or not, but at the conceit that we're somehow individuals and that we can be completely delimited, you know, monads.
Yes.
And I think it's she's completely like, you know, every one of her books is basically another argument for saying no, we're not, and it's actually impossible. You just as soon as you think you are separate, or, you know, not even just an individual, but you're a separate, like a group separate from all other groups, or a person separate from all other persons, basically bad things happen. You know, what triggers the apocalypse in Dawn is a small group of people sort of set themselves off from the rest of humanity and then destroy humanity. In the parable books, the philosophy of Earthseed is basically a form of mutualism, and what destroys it is a group of people who think they are better than all the other humans. They're a separate chosen people. Or in Fledgling, you know, the problem is actually sort of a weird inversion of that, where an individual who is trying to reintegrate herself into the world is seen as a problem for everyone else in her species, basically. So Butler just keeps coming back to this whole question of power in relationships, and it actually struck me when I was reading Fledgling how powerfully that not necessarily sums up, you know, that in Butler's career, but it is a very interesting reiteration of that. And then I went back over early stuff and I thought, this just keeps coming back. She really wanted people, I thought, to realize that in a sense there's no such thing as an individual at the level of some kind of completely discrete cutoff being.
Hmm.
Yeah. All that and some of the most beautiful prose that I've read in science fiction. Mm-hmm.
She's the right great thing, there. Yeah. The great thing about this is that it's deeply philosophical, but it's not dry.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of immediacy when she not just in using first person narrative, but just in the language, in focusing on what people feel as things happen. It's very well written, and the design of the language is really very intentionally focused on getting the reader to have an emotional, even embodied reaction to what's going on in the story. And again, she often uses the characters, the way that she constructs the characters actually sort of reinforces this, like Lauren with her hyper-empathy in the parable books. So that's what Butler kind of wants to happen to the readers, for them to have that kind of reaction to sort of really resonate. And her prose is just very wonderfully constructed to be constantly evocative and just draw you in and draw you in and draw you in. When I reread the first part of Dawn today, I had forgotten how actually very little happens in the first section. Basically, this woman sits in a room with an alien, and that's pretty much the action. And then she eventually touches the alien, and that's a huge thing. Like, the most exciting thing that happens in the first, 40 pages is she touches the alien. But Butler does such a great job of holding your attention and drawing you in and getting you to feel what contact is like and watch this woman go through all of these emotions as she comes to terms with what has happened to her, that, you just have to sit back and just kind of be in awe of the way that she can do that. It's like, how many writers could actually do that? How many writers could have two people sit in a room for 40 pages or so and have the only real physical action be, one of them touches the other one and eats a couple times. And yet you're drawn in and you really feel something very profound by the end of that interaction.
Something else that's a little weird thinking about Dawn, especially, because one of the reasons the Owen Colley are so into Lilith, especially, is they keep referring to her family's quote unquote talent for cancer. Right? And so
Was particularly
thinking now about Sarah and Jay and Ian Banks and everybody else we've lost. The list is sometimes it feels infinite. But this alien perspective looking at us and saying, well, you're an interesting species, but what makes you most interesting is this freaky thing that sometimes happens to your bodies that we've never seen before. And I don't know a lot of writers who would have the courage to step outside of a disease experience that has affected us all so powerfully and look at it from that kind of perspective, as is like, what if this is one of the things that makes us unique? And what if we found people that appreciate this unique thing that we do that we hate so much and want to incorporate it into their own biology? Because the Owen Colley, this species, they go around the galaxy interbreeding with other species, trying to incorporate their genetic strengths into the Owen Colley's. And I don't know if I'm saying that right, but that's the way I've always pronounced it in my head since I was a teenager. But always incorporating these new genetic talents into their genome, and they're collecting. And what makes us special is cancer. That always just struck me as, I'm still not sure how I feel about it, to be honest.
Mm-hmm. Well, that discomfort is something that ran heavy through a lot of those stories, too.
Yeah.
I mean, she was...
And yet you love her.
Yeah, well, I remember in reading Dawn and the whole, the point that kept being hammered home, both in reviews and in a lot of the scholarly studies that were being done of SF at the time, was the fact that she was, tackling, human hierarchical thought, and everyone said, yeah, and then you get deeper into the books and that's just the tip of the iceberg, She really starts dismantling the entire human psyche as a petri dish that the Owen Colley are examining quite closely.
But so accessibly.
With loving reverence as well.
So. Right. And so accessibly. So I think I was maybe 14 when I first read her, and a lot went over my head, but I still just got the real emotional impact of it. And, of course, the sci-fi coolness of it all.
Right.
But returning to them as a young adult, and now I'm middle-aged and reading them again, and she's got something for everybody. Fred, have you read her at all?
I believe I've read some years ago, which unfortunately I can no longer remember, though. John's description of the scene sitting in a room with an alien strikes a chord. What I read recently was Kindred, which is a story about a woman who time travels back to the 1800s to the household of someone she is related to. And found it very mixed read for me, partly because I didn't really like one of the characters, the husband, Kevin.
It's hard to like Butler's male characters, I think.
Yeah.
Really hard to like. Her male characters are almost always, oof.
And I also was kind of like, not really confused, but just bothered by the time travel mechanism. I almost wish she had just dumped the main character in the past and left her there for the entire period, because that was the part of the book that I really liked, was the description of the, you know, just the horrifying life on the plantation and everything. And, you know, that was just really gripping and really realistic. And, you know, I just kept like, okay, she's back in the present. Let's skip ahead now here and the next crisis and find out what's going on.
Yeah, I kind of felt the same way as Fred did with Kindred.
And I did start a second book, but as we will hear in Culture Consumed, I had to put it down because I was just overwhelmed by highfalutin literary science fiction lately. But we'll get to that later.
Yes, yes, we will.
I did want to point out that I did not realize until this afternoon, and I'm going to forget the name of who wrote it, but hold on, I'll do a quick lookup. Over at Tor.com, who was it who did the overview of the three books? It was Erica Nelson.
Okay.
This is back in 2009. I went and read her reactions to Dawn, and I thought she pretty much nailed it on the head. She came to it as somebody who was sort of experiencing the books for the first time, and it was October of 2009. So it started in September, but she did Dawn, Adulthood, Rights, and Imago, and does a very good write-up of them. And I remembered them when they came out and totally forgot about it as we were prepping for this until I found it this afternoon. So, but yeah. I definitely lost a big one when she went, but fortunately we have a host of material. She did write some shorter works as well. I know she had at least one, was it novella that was up for a Hugo?
Well, we were talking before we started recording about the early, you know, the 80s Isaac Asimov, and I remember the first story of hers I read appeared in there, and it was Bloodchild.
Oh, yes, 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 Bloodchild.
I really want to go back and read some more of her shorter fiction, because I have a feeling, as good as her novels are, her short stories probably pack even more punch. Because I still remember Bloodchild. And I don't remember what it was about, but I just remember that was one of the first things I read in the magazine. That
yeah,
really
same here.
Oh my God, science fiction is my genre.
I think the first thing I read of hers was also Bloodchild in the original Asimov's. And she actually didn't like writing short fiction. She declared several times in interviews and stuff that it was hard. She much preferred writing novels. She always thought of herself as a novelist, really. But Bloodchild was a very powerful experience on a lot of levels. And, well, you know, and
I'm reading.
from when I read it, I was actually at a point where I was sort of transitioning from reading sort of a lot of space opera and sword and sorcery, you know, so I guess, you know, sort of say less sort of philosophically fraught material for the most part. I remember very clearly reading that and going, my first thought was, how did this get into Asimov's?
Yeah.
Leah Bloodchild is a great story. And did she win for that?
I want to say she did.
I think she at least got the Nebula, if not.
Yeah,
don't have the history in front of me.
Well, she's won Hugo. She's won the Nebula. I don't keep track of awards the way I probably should, I'll be honest. But, yeah.
Yes, Hugo.
Time to be seeing, you know, I was just thinking around that same period was the first time I read a Lucius Shepard story, and we just lost him.
Yep.
It was military science fiction, and I just blanked on the name of it, but I'll think of it about a half hour after we're done recording.
Yeah, I just watched you one.
Life during wartime. That's it. Thank you.
There you go.
So, and I have this false memory that they were in the same issue, but they were probably a couple months apart.
Wow, that'd be wild if they were. Bloodchild won Locus, Nebula, and Hugo.
Oh wow!
Yeah,
great.
And Speech Sounds in 84 won Best Short Story too. So she swept on that one. Awesome.
Yes. We love you, Octavia, wherever you are. And I'm not going to read the parable books for a while yet. I'm saving them for when I need them.
Okay. Well, are you aware that there's two new stories of hers coming out this summer?
Okay. Yes. I'm looking forward to it very much.
I've already got that on pre-order from Open Road, so.
Oh. Click, click, click.
Adding the shopping cart now.
Oh, my goodness.
Yes, instant
says the shopping cart man.
It's a horrible thing sometimes.
Fred is the shopper.
Yeah.
My goodness.
Mount to be read just increases. Yep. So we were gonna talk about culture consumed, but something that we did want to bring up was, I believe, gentlemen, the three of us,
The Martian,
read The Martian.
I did not read The Martian.
Leave the room right now, but I already have it. So go.
Okay. I'm very bad. I did not get to The Martian.
Okay. Jeff and I can blather.
Okay, well, Fred, why don't you give me your take on it?
Well, this is The Martian by Andy Weir, Weir, and it's the gritty but oftentimes laugh-out-loud amusing story of a man who is left behind for dead on Mars and how he has to survive until the people on Earth can, A, discover that he's alive, and, B, mount a rescue mission to bring him back. So, a really cheap science fiction movie that is a favorite of mine is one called Robinson Crusoe on Mars. It was one of George Powell's last efforts. And there's many other stories where people are shipwrecked on various planets. So this is kind of a subgenre that I've always been fond of. And I'm definitely a sucker for anything that takes place on Mars. You know, especially in the Viking onward kind of Mars that, you know, Kim Stanley Robinson or John Varley or Jeffrey Landis and many others wrote about.
Mm-hmm.
I just want to know, does he ever encounter a terrifying AI jungle civilization like Alistair Reynolds made up? We remember.
No, but he does encounter disco and lots of 70s television and all sorts of other terrifying stuff. I found it to be a really good mix of not only hard science fiction, because he talks about, you know, breaking down rocket fuel to help him survive or whatever, mm-hmm. you know, fill in the blank, whatever process. But, you know, it's if you look at the coverage that CNN did of the Malaysian jetliner,
yep.
you can see where, you know, in this book, well, that's not too far off. This would happen.
Yeah.
And NASA being pretty much run by the PR people, you know, who have no idea of any engineering or science. And I mean, there's just so yep. much in there. I'm like, yeah, I can see that. Yep, that's happened.
Come on. Think of all the NASA people that we follow on Twitter that are very good PR people, but they know what they're talking about.
Well, you bring up a good point here, Kate, that I want to that was one of the reactions I had. Number one, that I think the tweet that I wrote was that this was competence porn at its best.
Yes.
Yes, it's in my book. It's a comedy. In my book, this is an engineering comedy, which is a rare thing. it's a comedy of misadventure. It's a comedy of errors, but I refer to it as this is the spiritual opposite of Cold Equations. This is a book where no margin of error goes unexploited. This is a book where no redundancy system does not get cannibalized. This is a book where everything that is possibly at hand is utilized. And in a very non-dry way either. This is actually a fairly quick read.
Yes.
But the point that you make about Twitter, the one issue that I had with the book, and it was a minor issue, but it built up as the book went on, is that it's not until quite a bit of time has passed before we see another POV, aside from Mark Watley, the astronaut on Mars. And we start seeing what's going on at NASA as they realize what's going on and they start trying to find ways to resolve the issue. And in the meantime, while this is happening, the ship that had been on the mission is on its way back to Earth, and everybody on the ship thinks that Mark is dead on Mars. And I found it something very weird has happened with technology lately, and that is if I see a story that's contemporary or forward that does not have a major social component to it, it feels dated.
Yes.
And this story at times felt almost excessively low tech. You know, he was evoking, you know, there was a lot of Maroon and there was a lot of, you know, Apollo 13 in it and stuff like that. But it felt it almost felt anachronistic, you know, even though it isn't. Even though we talked about composites and stuff like that, there really wasn't much when it came to the way of communication technology. I mean, I read this book right after a bunch of, crowdsourcing technicians, you know, reestablished communication with a satellite everyone thought was dead.
Right. You know? Right.
So the timing was awful. What happens is the book is, for the most part, told from the point of view of Mark's log that he's keeping on Mars. Well, as the climax approaches, the climax is going to be a very, very hands-on thing, which you can't log about unless you open the log with, well, I make it, and then try to tell the exciting story of what happened. So in order to keep the tension ramped up, he kind of abandons the POV and goes with the secondary narrative that he's been going with, which was, it took a little bit of the impact out of it, but not too much. I mean, the story definitely does grip and keep gripping. And given the time span that it takes over, that was something I was very worried about. Mm-hmm. But I did like it. I would like to have seen more of the alternate POVs of NASA and the ship crew. I think they could have added a bit of color to it. And I would like to have seen a lot more of the impact of what was happening on Earth. I said something very recently. What was the what was the book about the novel about the mission? I forget what it was. There was a book that recently came out that I read that involved a mission to somewhere near Jupiter or something like that that goes wrong. And there is a lot of references to the chat rooms and tweets that are being made back on Earth. And it was refreshing to see that. The problem was it sort of made the assumption that everybody on Earth is as invested in what's going on in space as all of us are, you know?
It wasn't the Europa mission, was it?
No.
That movie?
No. This is a book.
Okay.
Jeff, you remember what this is. I want to read it.
Yeah, I will remember and post it. I've been so knee-deep in so many books I forgot.
I mean, the funny thing about what you're saying, though, is, on the other hand, Alan Steele, his one book, Tranquility Alternative, which was part of his Robert Goddard alternative history, he had this, like, America Online service that the characters referenced every now and then from, like, the space station. And even then, which was, you know, as America Online was on the ascendancy, that felt aged to me for some reason. It just was weird. So the balance is, you know, you got Vernon Vingay in Fire Upon the Deep. He has pretty much interstellar, not really chat rooms, but, you know, the old Usenet arguments going on an interstellar scale. I mean, that held, for some reason, feels like it's held up better than some other social media kind of things.
No, I see where you're coming from. That makes a lot of sense. I thought I still had the audiobook here, but I cannot find it. I will post it when I figure out what it is.
Yeah, I'm curious too.
Yeah.
Did either of you read, I want to say it was Mary Roach, How to Survive on Mars?
Oh, How to Pack for Mars.
Pack for Mars.
Yes, that was a good one.
I keep thinking of that as I listen to you guys talking about it. I love that.
Yeah, there are a couple of very good books about life in space. I mean, there's a guy named Henry S.F. Cooper who wrote a book about Skylab that helped inspire Spider and Gene Robinson when they wrote the first Starmine story, where they have the ballet dancers in space. And there's a couple of basically variations on how do you go to the bathroom in space books that are, you know, sort of like The Roach. all amusing.
Or well, anyways, yeah, we highly recommend it, especially for the lover of comedy and for the hard SF engineering type thing. You know, quite frankly, it's gotten to the point in life where I'm willing to bet there are. Was it actually published under an SF imprint?
It came out initially. He self-published it.
Oh, okay.
And it's on the SF shelves, at least all the bookstores I've seen it in.
But I think it got picked up by one of the big six, didn't it?
Yeah, it did. It's now republished, and soon to be a major motion picture.
Good. Mm-hmm. And I could actually
only if Cuarón directs it will I watch that.
I could actually see them actually pumping up and playing up the comedy more.
Oh, here we go. I've got the hardcover. It's Crown.
There you go.
Let me just page through. I mean, it's got a picture of Mars. It's got a guy in a spacesuit. Library of Congress catalog. No, they don't list the Library of Congress like they used to, where they say where it was put under. But it's certainly, I mean, with a picture of Mars and a picture of a guy in a spacesuit, that's pretty science fiction-y.
Yep. I'm just saying we're rapidly approaching the point where it's not. So.
Yes. Yeah, well.
Groovy. So, yes, recommended by us.
Yep.
So.
We like to make you spend money, people.
Yes. Well, the impression I got from what John said earlier is that he's either been spending money or borrowing books at a prodigious rate and has not been thoroughly pleased with them. And what? I'd like to hear what that's all about.
What? I love everything.
Oh, I heard somebody broke your heart a little bit.
No, just, you know, overwrote about it, I guess. I don't know. Well, I was going to say for Culture Consumed, I was actually going to bring up Octavia Butler again briefly because I read Fledgling, I highly recommend that to everybody if you didn't already get that from the earlier part of the podcast. Also because in some ways it's a bit of a departure for her because she's writing about something that's very, I guess you could say, pop cultural, which is vampires, but doing it in such a distinctively Butlerian way that she really brings some interesting pondering to the table for the reader. And I just wanted to kind of reiterate that. But also, I was, as I mentioned before we started the show, I received a couple of Christopher Priest's new books in the mail, The Adjacent and The Islanders. And I am sad to report that I was rather disappointed with them. And this comes from someone who thought The Inverted World was a fantastic book.
It is a treasure.
It is a fantastic book. And to be fair, The Islanders is better, I think, than The Adjacent. But it felt a little indulgent. I got the feeling a little bit from both these books that Priest seems very satisfied with himself. And I didn't feel there was a lot of pushing going on. I mean, when I read The Prestige, which is the other major book that I read by Priest, it felt a little self-satisfied, and that's sometimes an undertone that I catch in his writing. Mm-hmm. But it was also very, he was also really trying to write something very, very specifically focused and crisp, and that The Prestige really does the job it's supposed to do very well. And The Inverted World is just fantastic. It felt kind of revolutionary to me when I read it the first time. But The Adjacent, I remember very clearly reading, getting to the end and going, really? That's it? There's a feeling of an incredible buildup. And then you get to the end and you feel like you've just been kind of left there. Like the writer's like, get out of the car, this is as far as I'm taking you, I'm out of here. And I thought, you know, Priest sometimes likes to be, you know, subtle and oblique, but this is ridiculous.
Islanders is part of that set on something called the Dream Archive.
Both books, like there are some parts of The Adjacent that are set in the Dream Archipelago.
Okay, I seem to recall having started reading one of those and not being able to finish it. Now that I think about
The Islanders is set in the Dream Archipelago, and I liked it better than The Adjacent.
Okay,
but it still felt the feeling that I got every time I, you know, put it down to move on and do something else after a session of reading was, I just felt that I was kind of being patronized a little bit by the author. Sort of like, I know who I am, and you're going to get what I think you should get because I am who I am. And that's not a feeling I like to get, you know, from a book. Which I should say is the complete opposite of what I get out of Butler's books. I feel that, like, every book that Butler ever wrote, she was pushing herself as well as trying to push the reader.
Yeah.
And that's something that I really admire in an author, and something that I've gotten out of earlier Christopher Priest books, but did not get out of these two. And then the other thing that I have been reading a lot of, and this is not because I'm buying them, it's because I'm borrowing them from my from my bookstore that I work at, is I've been reading a lot of graphic novels. In the classic superhero mode, and I've read a pretty significant stack of various topics, and most of them I have liked. They have been remarkably okay, I guess is the best way to put it. Remarkably okay. Well, I went through a period where I think the last time on this show I may have actually said I'd read a string of graphic novels that I just did not like very much. They weren't very good.
Remember that.
Some of them were promising, but most of them just didn't live up to the promise. So I actually read the Winter Soldier sequence, the first two graphic novel collections of Ed Brubaker's Winter Soldier storyline for Captain America. Partly because I'm eventually going to see the movie and I was interested in a comparison, but you know, it had actually been recommended by a number of comics readers as a really excellent, really excellent, you know, comic story to read. And I read it, and it just seemed a little too contrived and a little too gimmicky. And what I had hoped to see was someone, and this is something that you never find in Captain America because this is not really what the hero's all about, is, you know, getting into Captain America's head and understanding his perspective as the person that he is, this man out of time who feels that he has to be a hero and he has to be a symbol. And there have been a few stories where I've kind of felt people have tried to get under that, get behind, you know, get in his head and look out through his eyes. And I'd hoped that was going to happen here, and it really didn't. It just felt like a fairly gimmicky, slightly noir-inflected story. That was fine. It was fine, but it just didn't... I didn't find it to be as mind-blowing or interesting as a lot of other readers seem to have.
Huh. Well, so it sounds like Brubaker's really playing to his own strengths, because
his
work is really very crime.
Brubaker does a much better job with crime narratives. He really seems to have a grasp of getting into those people's heads. And I didn't feel that he was really getting into Steve Rogers' head. And that's kind of what I was hoping would happen. And then I also read The Avengers World graphic novel collection, which I think was Hickman and Opeña.
Yes.
Which had really good art and an extremely intriguing storyline that felt really truncated and that really couldn't go in a lot of the directions that it could have. I found it to be kind of a missed opportunity kind of story where something interesting would really happen and then they couldn't develop it because it's a superhero story and they got to get on to the next fight or the next conflict or the next whatever. I just felt they kept missing really interesting moments. I wanted more out of it than it had, and it seemed very intriguing. And then it would just move on to the next conflict, and I thought, well, why don't you go back and deal with the thing that just happened?
Yeah.
Which would be really cool. And then the last one that I'll talk about is the Thor's Journey into Mystery, Everything Burns. Which again, had really good art and had some great moments in it. But
who drew that?
Who drew that? A bunch of people, according to the front cover. I see like five different names. But I think it's also confusingly organized, so I can't flip right to the name of. Alan Davis did some of it, and that's probably some of the best art in the collection. But there were four different artists, who worked in different aspects of the art. I think it's primarily Alan Davis, and then it switches over, I think, at some point to someone else. The problem is with these graphic novels is that. I remember the good old days when they just reproduced the comic, including the page with all the credits on it. And apparently they don't do that anymore because, you know, they're books. But, you know, they're a comic book. And if there's four different artists and four issues, how the hell do you know what's going on? At the end, I think they sometimes provide the breakdown. But the art's good. The art's great. And actually, one thing that I really did like about this is I thought they really did some great layout stuff. There's an animated feel to a lot of the art because they use obliquely weirdly angled panels and, you know, panels that fit into each other. And I thought they actually did in terms of layout and for most of the art, I thought they did a really good job. But the story was interesting at points, and then I felt kind of got flattened out. There was too much talking and narrating sometimes, like more than was really needed for. I mean, there's this effort, especially towards the middle, to try to make it kind of an epic saga kind of narrative. And I appreciated that, but it just seemed to slow down what was going on. It's hard in comics to include large blocks of text all the time. Because your eye wants to move on. It's like
Right.
I'm reading this, but there's a cool picture over there that my eye keeps going to that I want to get to. Can we stop with the narrating? Stop monologuing. But you know what the weirdest thing about this book is that I couldn't get into? Was the teenage Loki.
You know, I
could not engage with the teenage Loki.
I've got a bit of a love-hate with that, and I'll tell you why. Because were you around when they brought Loki back as a woman a few years ago?
I haven't seen that yet.
Because that experiment failed miserably. Currently, there's a current Loki book called Loki, Agent of Asgard, which kind of follows up with the Journey into Mystery stuff.
Okay.
Which has been 4 issues so far, and I highly recommend it because it's been a lot of fun. So much happened. There was that one entire arc with the teenage Loki that was basically almost like a riff on Vertigo comics in general, and Sandman in particular, that I thought he was very effective for. But a lot of times, yeah, you're right. It did become a mess. But I think part of the reason they did that was for the follow-up to what happened after Asgard fell on Oklahoma back in whatever book that was, Fear Itself or one of them, I forget.
Right, I think that's Fear Itself, yeah. So I actually liked this better than the other stuff that I mentioned, the Winter Soldier and the Avengers World. And I actually want to reread it because the art was so interesting and the way that they cut the panels and created a sense of flow. But I kind of want to go back and read it again to see if I was just a little too impatient in my reading in some spots, like especially those couple of spots where there seemed to be a little too much, you know, a little too much narration or writing going on. Because there's some intriguing stuff that happens, and I really felt that they took some chances with layout and with how they shaped the look of the story. Of all the stuff I've sort of just mentioned in my diatribe here, that's probably the thing that I would most recommend is going to read that.
Well, on a scale of one to Walt Simonson, then that's the last Thor that I had to give you an
right.
idea.
I think there are parts of this that are close to Simonson.
Ooh.
You see, now I want to see...
I think Alan Davis is a really good artist. I think Alan Davis is a very good artist. I find few other artists who can match him for facial expression and for a feeling of fluidity in the character's poses and action. Like, there's sometimes a little bit of a cartoony aspect to his work, I think. And he's someone who really needs an inker who will rein in the cartoonishness a little bit, unless that's what he's going for specifically. Mm-hmm. Like, we needed Darren Quinch with Alan Moore.
Right.
And that's perfect. Like, his art was, like, they couldn't have found a more perfect artist to do the Darren Quinch
exactly. Yeah.
Than Alan Davis. Like, the sort of almost inevitable roundness he often brings to features and stuff like that. Everything was just perfect there. Mm-hmm. And I like him drawing this comic. Although, like I said, I don't think he drew it all. I think there's a shift at some point. There's at least one issue in it that looks clearly like a different artist. But on a scale of one to Simonson, I think there are several parts of this that are very close to Simonson. And like I said, I think of all the stuff I also just mentioned, I really want to go back and reread that. To see if part of my reaction was just me being dissatisfied with a few choices they made about aspects of the story, but also aspects of the construction of the visuals themselves.
Well, Kate's comment now has me wanting to read Teenage Loki Meets Frog Thor. So. for a 12-issue story arc. So, Kate, what have you been sticking your nose in?
Well, I'm still recovering from the last two, really. Before I read the latest Gene Wolfe, I read the latest Tony Burgess. And you guys may know Tony Burgess for Pontypool. Have any of you guys read Pontypool Changes Everything?
No.
Well, no, I have not.
Tony Burgess, he's a rural Ontario, he's almost a poet. His writing is so good. And Pontypool, the novel is called Pontypool Changes Everything, but there's also a movie just called Pontypool. And it's told from the perspective of the radio station that's kind of trying to cover what's happening. But it's, at least on the most pathetic layer of reality, it's zombie fiction. But Pontypool zombieism is a disease spread through language. So it's very conceptual and makes your brain hurt. And his new one is called The End Body Problem.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
I have heard of this. Yes. Okay.
And in this version of zombie fiction, zombies are basically people keep moving after they're dead. They twitch, they thrash around. So you bury them in the ground and they eventually thrash their way back up to the surface. And so there's basically the wiggling dead everywhere. And someone has gotten the bright idea to launch them into space to get them out of the way. So eventually there's all this biomass orbiting the Earth, and it's blocking out the sun, and it's causing climate problems. And meanwhile, the people on Earth are experiencing all kinds of weird-ass psychological symptoms, and everybody's suddenly a hypochondriac of some kind, and it's all kind of somehow maybe based on vitamin D deficiency and whatever. But, you know, the fundamental problem of dead people still twitch around and the only way to get rid of them is to launch them into space. And there's a doomsday cult roaming around rural Ontario who's convincing people that the only way to, the only relief for the misery of this existence is basically mass suicide. And it's just one of the weirdest, most disturbing books I've ever read. And it's been a couple of months and I'm still recovering from the imagery because Burgess is one sick puppy. And I've talked to him a little bit on Twitter and I think he's probably a really, really nice person, but he scares me. And so I'm recovering from that. So then what do? I pick up the brand new Gene Wolfe, The Land Across. And Gene Wolfe, basically, as far as I'm concerned, exists to make my brain hurt. And now someone pointed out he looks like the Pringles guy. So now all I can think of is... So Pringles face is writing... And it's really kind of the most dumbass, low-hanging fruit idea I could think of someone like him tackling. So... What are the two most famous things in Central Europe in literary terms? So we've got Franz Kafka and we've got Dracula. And so sooner or later, someone was going to try and combine the two. And Gene Wolfe did? So, you know, on the first layer, and I've only read the book once, you've got a travel writer who's decided he's going to write the first book about this newly liberated, newly capitalist, tiny little Central European country and getting arrested at the border and experiencing this little Kafka-esque dystopia. But The Land of Cross is obviously a referral to Transylvania. And there's just enough oblique little mentions of Vlad the Impaler and all these little hints there and there that basically you're dealing with a Dracula story. And because this is Gene Wolfe, everybody's identity is sort of compounded and compacted, and we don't know how many different timelines we're dealing with. I think sometimes of the house in the Book of the New Sun, the house where, I forget the giant's name, but the bottom floor is in one timeline and the middle floor is in one timeline, the top floor. Mm-hmm. So it kind of feels like there's something like that going on. And there's a character who basically he's a dealer in voodoo supplies and he makes life-size voodoo dolls that you can customize. And there's a disembodied hand and we can't decide if it's something benign like Cousin It or something more malign. And It's a hell of a book, and I'm still not sure I understand what was going on. I'm going to have to read it like 5 or 6 times.
Right.
Nothing wrong with that.
Right. Well, does anybody read Gene Wolfe just once?
No.
No.
You're talking to the wrong audience here.
I mean, I'm on a mailing list where that's all they do is reread and reread and reread and
dissect
further and further.
I was just reading all of the discussions on Earth today, yep. The Land Across, and all these ideas that hadn't even occurred to me. Like, some people think the girl in the wall is the protagonist's mother murdered when he was 6 years old, and I'm like, what?
Sometimes I'm like, you guys need to get a hobby, or another hobby.
But there's so many weird, tantalizing little things, like, there's a girl that occurs a couple times in cafes, and there's so many cafes in this book, it's like, mm-hmm. Is this Transylvania or Vienna? But there's a girl with a red pen that he keeps noticing. And suddenly at the end of the story, she's incredibly important. And you don't see that coming because it's just she's window dressing. And that's Gene Wolfe right there.
Wow.
Bastard.
Wow. Yeah, I saw your review on that on your website. It was a very... that was a book that actually managed to go under my radar, and very few Gene Wolfe things do. So
yeah, he should come with cheat codes for people who have a lot of reading to do. I can't devote my whole life to you, man. I'm sorry. I love your work, Gene, but damn, there's all these other writers, like Tony Burgess.
That's awesome.
Fred, what about you, man?
Well, before Fred starts, the book I was trying to think of was Heaven's Shadow by David Goyer and Michael Cassatt.
Thank you.
It was the first book of a trilogy. I have not gotten to the second two yet, but Heaven's Shadow is ripe with the social media following and reactions to what is going on both the NASA mission and the Russian Indian mission to the near-Earth object that is approaching. Oh. And that part is done very well. I just thought it was a tiny bit too enthusiastic, that's all.
So we got Heaven's Shadow, Heaven's Fall, and Heaven's War, it looks like.
I believe War was
War's
the second.
War is the second, yeah.
Yeah.
Heaven's Shadow good. More good. Books to read. Thank you, Jeff.
Yeah, I do what I can. So, Freddie, what are you reading?
Well, do you want me to go with the graphic first or the words on the page first?
Dealer's choice.
Well, just to mention briefly, my usual goal for short stories started many years ago because some guy named John DiNardo said he was going to try and read a short story a day.
Oh, I did that for a while.
Yep. Well, I am now at 358.
Woo!
And since it's only May, this could be a very, very interesting year for short stories. My definition of short works is kind of loose. For example, I count a issue of Locus as like four short stories. And I'm counting each, as you'll see in the graphical end, I'm counting some Marvel Comics as a short story. So, you know, it bulks it up, but it's my blog, my rules. You know, what can I say? Books... written books as opposed to graphical books. A lot of what I did since the last episode was I was invited to participate on a podcast called The Incomparable, which I've been listening to since the single digits, and I was invited to participate on episode number 196. So we will provide a link. And what we did was, and we includes not only two of the regulars on the show, but a Mr. Paul Weimer and a Mr. Sean Duke, both of whom everyone here probably has heard of. We discussed the nebulas, and I had at this point read 6 of the 8. And that's part of the reason why I couldn't get to a second Butler, nor could I get to the Gene Wolfe before tonight. Mm-hmm. Because those 6 books, I mean, they were all excellent reads. And if you listen to the episode, you'll see that all of us really enjoyed all of the books. But after all those 6 books, especially the Sophia Samatar, which to me was like a very, very rich meal, my brain's just broken for literary at this point. And spoilers, I will say that I think while we all liked Ancillary Justice, a book called The Golem and the Genie may have edged it out as being what we would have picked for the Nebula Award winner this year. So I don't know if anybody else has read that one yet.
It's on my mountain.
Okay, well, bump it up. That's all I'll say.
Okay.
I really enjoyed it. I also read a lot of things, like, for example, I reread The Art of War by Sun Tzu. I read Jeff Vandermeer's Annihilation in one day, and I'm looking forward to the second one in that trilogy, which is now out. I read The Crying of Lot 49 as part of what is called Pynchon in Public Day. And I reread The Dying Earth by Jack Vance for the 1,000,000th time. Because someone was expressing amazement that Chip Delaney was black, I read, again, Atlantis Three Tales. Just because that was my private protest over some idiocies on a commenting about a news story. And I just finished another David Drake today. And, of course, I'm reading 25 books simultaneously as usual.
Yes.
And on the graphical end of things, I'm both going backwards and moving forwards. I decided to try and pick up some of the classic Marvel titles since I saw The Avengers and really liked it and liked at least half the season of Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. So I went back and got some of the mid-60s Avengers saying, okay, now I can find out about the origin stories of all these guys. Only to learn that, well, no, Thor's been around since the 1940s and Captain America. Like, God damn it, I gotta buy more. But, it's all campy, it's all good. And many of these titles, Jeff and John, I blame for buying, but it's all in jest because I'm enjoying what I'm reading. But I've also branched out. For example, I just picked up Transmetropolitan.
Oh, that's the best.
Okay, I'm going to give that a try. I picked up and subscribed to Trees, the new one from Warren Ellis.
I was going to talk about that in a minute.
Okay, well, I haven't read it yet. I just got the first issue. I've picked up Planetary. I'm trying to cast a wide net and see what I've been missing for all these decades. So that's that's my culture. Oh, other than seeing Godzilla twice.
Ah.
Because it turns out my daughter is a real giant monster fan, and we never knew it.
Wow, that's good. As family secrets go, that's one that we encourage.
Yes, definitely.
Awesome. Yep. Yeah, I read the first issue of Trees by Warren Ellis, who we spoke about at length on this very podcast. Yes. And art is by Jason Howard. The first issue is a setup where we meet a number of different people on Earth and how they are dealing with the fact that some very large objects appeared out of nowhere and landed on Earth and have basically been doing nothing since they landed. And it's basically a story about people on a planet that now has evidence of alien life sitting on it, dominating the skylines. First issue was pretty much a setup, but it was a very compelling setup. One of the storylines is about a guy who's considering running for mayor of New York City. And it's good. It's good. I did like it. The other comic that I'm kind of excited about right now, I'm getting a buzz from someone here. Don't know where it's coming from. The other comic that started first issue just came out, I believe this week, it might have been the week before, is Mark Andreyko and Piotr Kowalski have brought back Nightbreed. Clive Barker's Nightbreed has a new comic.
Yes.
And I picked up the first issue with that, and that was also very good. For novels, aside from The Martian, I reread Greybeard by Brian Aldiss, just because I had to, because it popped up on my e-reader. I listened to the audiobooks of the three Expanse novels, which I was threatened with loss of nerd points if I did not get off my ass and consume. And I liked them. But once again, this is a recurring theme with this. I thought they were somewhat low-tech. To the point where you could almost make the argument that they take place in a slightly lower tech alternate history than everything else. When half the stuff I have on my desktop I don't understand, yet all the technology that's here I don't understand. Everything they do on a ship I can pretty much follow. Yeah, that becomes a bit of a bit of a of an indicator. Yeah, a little too much sometimes. And I just got the new Interzone and Black Static.
Yes.
And hopefully I will get to those tomorrow. And the one other bit of culture that I will mention, even though it is not a book or a comic or a movie, that I finally went to the Udvar-Hazy Smithsonian Air and Space Museum, known as America's Hangar, which is where they keep the space shuttle and the Enola Gay and a Concorde. And it's basically a big, giant, massive hangar that has several hundred airplanes in it of various sizes. And not just airplanes, but rockets. There's a sizable portion of a Saturn V. There's a few actual missiles in there, some warplanes, some ultralights. I kind of geeked out there for a bit. It was one of the more fun trips that I've taken when it comes to walking around looking at hardware. So that's about it for me. Anyone else got anything?
Well, so what's everyone going to read next? I'm getting all excited for Get Blank, which is the sequel to Justin Robinson's Mr. Blank, which is basically his hilarious version of the Illuminati. He takes the idea that there's one guy in every conspiracy that has to do all the dirty work. And it turns out that it's the same guy in every conspiracy, and that's who Mr. Blank is.
Oh, wow.
The sequel just came out, and I just snagged it, and I'm getting ready to... It's the first book was really, really funny, so I'm very excited. What about you guys?
Well,
it's me, so there.
It's you.
I am currently reading Robert Jackson Bennett's City of Stairs.
Oh, I don't have that yet. I hate you all.
It's good. So far, it's good. Bennett is one of those writers who I discovered fairly late.
Yeah,
I didn't discover him until this third novel. But now... he keeps switching gears and doing something different, and it's pretty amazing.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's on my that and the Peter Watts that's coming out, Echopraxia. Those are the two that will go straight to the top of my list when I get them.
Right.
I'm tonight, as soon as we're done with this, I'm going to be loading A Stranger in Alondria into my e-reader by Sophia Samatar, and what was the other? What was something else just came up that I was about to read? Oh, you know what I was gonna? Something I've never read before was the Nova Roma books by John Maddox Roberts. I've never read those. I like the Spacer books, but I never read the Nova Romas. So I'm going into them with no preconceived notions. So.
All right,
Fred.
Well, I'm going to be reading a lot of stuff. I just don't, you know. Every time I make a plan or decide something, I never end up doing it. But
yeah.
More than likely, I have not read the Jerry Cornelius books by Michael Moorcock in a long time. And I just started the first one and was like, I don't think I've read these since I read Elric. So it's just weird to find the first chapter in both this and the first Elric are pretty much parallels.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
I do have plans to read, speaking of Gene Wolfe, the new Sun books this year. I'm reading the rest of the Dying Earth books by Jack Vance. Since I got a dedication in the latest David Drake book, I'm working my way back through the Leary series again.
Mm.
Up to the 10th book, which is the one where I got a dedication. So, you know. And who knows what else? More Delaney.
You're finally going to read On the Steel Breeze so we can talk about it, right?
More Reynolds when that comes out.
I read that. I like that.
Oh. Alistair, if you listen to this, hurry the hell up with the next one.
Yes.
There need to be more elephants in space and whales.
Yep. the new Stephen Baxter when that gets released finally on this side of the pond. You know, I anybody who says they're bored and they don't have anything to read is just full of it. Let's put it that way. So
yeah.
I usually with an e-reader now, I start off, I read like the first chapter of about 7 or 8 books, and then I decide what's grabbing me and I finish. And e-readers are terrible for just sticking with one book.
Yeah, they are. Yeah, that's why I'm trying to be very disciplined by only loading one thing at a time, but then all the magazines show up automatically. And it just, hey, has anybody read, I may have asked this before, has anybody read the Chung Cao recast books, David Wingrove re-releasing his Chung Cao novels, expanding them?
Not the re-releases, no.
Because I like the first 5 or 6 of the original ones, and I've got the first 3 of the recast, which I guess is a good chunk of what happened before Chung Cao. It starts with Son of Heaven, I think, and then goes from there. I want to take a crack at those, but my God, they're so big.
Yes.
They're so big.
For light reading, I'll just work my way through the Wheel of Time this year before the Hugo.
You know, that's something I was, now that I have a little bit more free time at home, that was something that I was really considering, was trying to take a go at the whole thing. And I'm kind of scared by the idea, so.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
I'm thinking going through the solar cycle again, Gene Wolfe, because I started doing an in-depth read of New Sun last year, and then I got sidetracked, and I want to do all 13 in order again. Because summer, right? What else are you going to do? Yep. Oh, yeah, Sandbag.
Well, if you get them all on audio, you can sandbag while you listen.
Yeah. That's a good idea, actually. For those of you who don't know, I live in Saratoga, Wyoming, and we're currently our little sub-tributary of the Missouri River is flooding its banks. So we've got the National Guard and the Wyoming Cowboys football team here helping us with sandbagging.
Wow.
Yeah.
We've had a lot of rain, but no actual, we've had a few rivers go over, but nothing has been that bad yet. So
yep.
When we have floods here, they just tell the state tells us, hey, you're on your own. So
yep. Yeah, that used to be the way, but this town is full of old people, so I count as young and able-bodied.
Awesome. That's great.
That's a good idea. Book of the New Sun while we fill sandbags. That would, no one else would want to do that, but that's why there are earbuds, right?
You know, this might break the record for the sheer number of books we've mentioned in one podcast. I don't know, guys. We're starting to outdo ourselves.
That's okay.
Yeah. So to borrow,
I was going to say, I think we should wrap it up.
Yep, I was about
we may have set a new record on length too.
I'll check in a minute.
To
borrow the phrase from Patrick, anyone got any final thoughts?
Well, you guys aren't nearly as hoarse as I expected.
I drank my special tea before the show, so you know.
Good job.
And I walk around talking like this all day, just so I can be in shape for tonight. I annoy people at the grocery store and stuff like that. Excellent. Well, this is really good. And to all the listeners, we're hoping once again that we're not going to have as big of a gap. We're already planning on what we're going to do for July. And summer is here. Get your reading done. Good time to catch up. The kids are out of school. Get them hooked on SF or Godzilla. Whatever tack you want to take on that one.
And I'd like to make a special thank you to Kate for coming on and
putting
up with us.
Yeah. Hey, it's been a blast, you guys. Anytime.
Good to have someone who knows what they're talking about on this show once in a while. You know, sometimes we got a class to join up a little bit, you know?
So. You guys are awesome.
Thank you. We appreciate it.
It's really
good having you on. All right. Yeah, so
thanks
until
for coming.
Yeah, until next time, everybody, we hope you have a good June.
And good night.